coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Wilmington Mayor Mike Perzicki reflects on his career serving the state's largest city as he prepares to leave office.
We got it going, and looking back today, I'm so proud of what we did.
We bring you excerpts from our conversation with Mike Perzicki. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also delve into recommendations from a task force looking to address school climate issues and preview the upcoming holiday shopping season. Plus, Enlighten Me offers Thanksgiving dinner cooking tips that will help impress your guests. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. There will be a new mayor of Wilmington in 2025. Outgoing Governor John Carney won the office in this year's election. The office was open because Mike Perzicki decided to step aside and not seek a third term. Recently, contributor Larry Nagy sat down with Perzicki to reflect on his impact on the state's largest city, first as Riverfront Development Corporation Executive Director, then as mayor. Larry's piece, based on that interview, is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And this week on The Green, we're bringing you excerpts from Larry's conversation with Mayor Perzicki. We start with Perzicki's road to the mayor's office, an office he came to after guiding work to develop the Wilmington Riverfront as executive director of the Riverfront Development Corporation, the public-private partnership behind the massive riverfront project. It was a job Perzicki wasn't initially keen on taking.
I was busy doing a lot of things, and I got a call from a friend of mine who asked me about the riverfront, and I told him I wasn't interested, and so he called me back, and I said, I'm not interested, I told you that, and so he called my wife. And so I walked in the house, and she just started beating me over the head. She goes, you would love doing this. Think about the opportunity to do this whole riverfront.
Perzicki stepped into his role leading the RDC in 1996, and during his tenure, plans came and went, or were radically reimagined. Ultimately, he delivered on hopes for a viable, vibrant city space.
I came up to meet with Jim Sills when he was mayor. He came up here sitting in this office, and he was just telling me what a miserable time he was having over something. I can't remember what it was, but I would understand. I mean, being mayor is difficult. And I said to him, Jim, I said, go out and build something. They can never take it away from you. And that's how I've always felt about, you know, my experience down on the riverfront. Nobody can take away from us what we did down there, because it's right there for you to put your arms around. You can see it, you can feel it.
In 2016, Perzicki decided to build on his work developing the riverfront by running for mayor. He won an 8-way Democratic primary with less than a quarter of the votes cast, then secured a general election victory with 82% of the vote. He says his stint on the riverfront informed his approach to running the city and promoting its growth overall.
I'd love taking old beat-up properties and rehabilitating them. I did that to some extent my whole private sector life, but we certainly did on the riverfront. Everywhere you look, we put a big premium on aesthetics and cleanliness. In the end, I think the big failing that people have is either tragically they don't know, or they know what the right thing is and they just don't do it. And I think you see that all the time. It's so easy, at least from a formulaic point of view, for me, it's pretty easy to decide what to do, because most of the time, what to do is just the right thing. To start the day, just say, well, we have to do this. Why do we have to do it? Well, it's the right thing to do.
Perzicki sees multiple highlights to his time in office, starting with improving city parks and the William Hicks Anderson Community Center.
You go around the city, we have our handprints, fingerprints on so much down here that has changed. We spent $24 million on parks. We took the worst piece of garbage at William Hicks Anderson Community Center and made it a beautiful place.
He also points to the Wilmington Clean Team's work to make the city a better place.
They've never done it before. I can't imagine how the city must have looked, but we actually spent almost $1 million on clean teams all over the city. First thing in the morning, they go out and clean a neighborhood. And tragically, by the next morning, it needs it all over again. But imagine if you didn't do it, what the streets looked like.
But Perzicki's approach has had its detractors, with some expressing concern that his work to improve Wilmington ignored those with the greatest needs, pushing them out of the city. It's a critique Perzicki pushes back on.
You know, we sit here and we think, okay, here's the trajectory of revenue. Here's the trajectory of expenses. Here are the problems we have to solve. And here's what we have to do this. And so it's the only place that happens is right here. Everybody else, they think about their own little issue. Maybe they have some financial stress and they see all this affluence going on around them, you know, and they just are resentful. It's a pretty natural impulse, I think. When explained properly, I think you find people say, boy, I didn't realize that. Look, we have bills to pay. Those buildings pay the bills. And I try to tell them that. If you want us to have clean teams, somebody has to pay for that. We've got to be thinking about the health of the city writ large so that the city is affluent and thriving enough to do the things you're doing.
As he leaves the mayor's office, Perzicki is pushing one more big idea, redeveloping former MBNA Bank of America office buildings downtown into a new higher education hub, including Widener University Delaware Law School and Delaware State University's nursing program.
We're putting $10 million over on the bridge project. We want to bring the Del State's nursing and healthcare professionals up here and the Delaware Law School. You can't find a city our size anywhere around here that doesn't have some sort of major educational institution, except for us. And so this is such a great opportunity, and yet you'll see people pushing back against it like, you know, it's not for us. Well, it is.
But completing that plan will fall to incoming Mayor John Carney. As for Perzicki's future, he doesn't plan on completely stepping away from finding public service roles to play.
I'm really committed to rehabilitating Gibraltar. Finally, after years and years of decay, I'm serving as a trustee to Delaware State University. I'm very, very happy to do that. I've got my own personal investments that I work on. But there's nothing out of all that that's going to keep me getting up in the morning and working the way I do today. And I'm terrified of having a day that's not filled with challenges.
And Perzicki says he leaves the mayor's office grateful for the opportunities he's had to serve.
We change so much in the city, and with change comes, some emotional stress. But we got it going. And looking back today, I'm so proud of what we did. But I don't know what the hell's going to happen the day after I go home.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for sitting down with Wilmington Mayor Mike Perzicki for that exit interview. You can check out Larry's piece reflecting on Perzicki's tenure as mayor at DelawarePublic.org. Next up, we delve into Delaware's effort to address school climate and discipline issues with the lawmaker who led a task force that looked into those issues and recently offered its recommendations. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A task force in charge of finding solutions to the state's student behavior and school climate issues has delivered its final recommendations. This comes after the group spent months putting together the recommendations to help districts better address increasing reports of student behavior incidents and absenteeism. This week, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich spoke with Senate Majority Leader Brian Townsend, chair of the Student Behavior and School Climate Task Force, about the group's findings and next steps.
There's obviously a lot here, but give us the highlights of what the task force believes are some of the most crucial changes that need to be made to address student behavioral issues.
There's all kinds of drivers that go into this, but what seems to come out of it is a very serious situation in our schools where a lot of educators and students are frustrated or unimpressed with the status quo, and we've got to do better. Some of the specifics that have come from this are, and this is in, I guess, no particular order, the issue of cell phones. I mean, some districts have already begun moving either through a pilot program funded by the state or on their own to do a better job with limiting the negative role that cell phones can have with regard to students' ability to focus throughout the day on what's really important for them to be focusing on. So figuring out how to implement those programs effectively is something that is already underway at the district level, and we need to figure out what role the state should have in formalizing it, mandating it, funding it, however that looks. So that's one item. Transportation was a key focus. A lot of people think about behavior or other issues in the school classroom, in the hallways, but so much of what happens starts on the buses on the way to school or on the way home. We've long known that there is a challenge with recruiting and retaining bus drivers, given the lagging pay rates that they have seen over the years. There have been recent increases, but the reality is there's a really good question of whether or not, in addition to the drivers themselves, there should be additional staff on the bus so that the driver can focus on the safety of the road and the staff member can focus on what's going on with the students. There's a key question that had come up more towards the end of the task force is whether legislation a few years ago meant to support students actually might cause implementation challenges or impossibilities for schools. And it has to do with data and tracking and designating students. And essentially, you might have a situation where you have rightfully wanted there to be a concentration of students that are going through challenges in a place. But by doing that, you might actually cause problems for the institution, the school, or the program that is meant to serve the students with regard to additional reporting requirements that really just take away from the fact that the whole point of that program was to take on the most challenging students. So we're taking a look at whether the law needs to be changed to strike the right balance between, yes, transparency and reporting and data, but also not kind of tying the hands of the programs or the schools that need the support most. I guess I probably should start, honestly, one of the most important items is the issue of in-school programs for students who are going through behavior issues versus out-of-school programs. And we did learn that there have been some out-of-school programs that have been around for many, many years, but have not seen an increase in funding in literally decades. And the question is how effective are those programs? Apparently very effective by certain measures. And so figuring out the totality of what the programs involve and what they are doing well or could do a better job of while also bolstering their funding is a pretty important item. And then the issue of in-school alternatives. So it might be make sense to have a student leave the school building and go to an alternative placement for a period of days or weeks, or in some cases, even months. But what about the having options in the school building? At the heart of this, Sarah, is school funding and what funds flow to what school buildings for what students for what purposes. And we know very much now that educators are at, a tipping point with regard to their willingness and ability to continue bearing the status quo as they try to do the miracle worker job that we ask of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to get to the funding part of this a little bit later because that is honestly probably the most important piece of the puzzle here. But as you were just talking about, there is a section on more professional development for teachers, to help address these issues in the classroom. And I think in my listening into the meetings, teachers are largely saying that they simply don't have the time or the staff, right, to manage the behavior of a classroom while also getting through a curriculum. And then administrators, are also saying that they're doing the best that they can with the support and the staff that they have, but they need more parental support and more engagement on their behalf, which is also addressed in the recommendations. So I'm curious if following all the presentations and the meetings, if you see one group here that could use some more devotion to the issue, or if we really just do need, change at every level.
We definitely need change at every level. The issue of professional development for educators, it's a topic that comes up in so many different areas. And some people, maybe not in recent years as much as prior to that, had been like, oh, let's go ahead and, do some more PD for educators on that topic. And that's just not the magic solution here is not more PD for educators. There is no doubt that there needs to be an ongoing commitment to restorative practices and understand that you can't just kind of like remove someone and call it a day and expect they're going to like literally in some cases heal just by having been removed. So there is a process to try and maximize, that's what they call it, restorative, like restoring those students to being on a path where they can try to fulfill their potential. It's very important that educators learn that, embrace that in an iterative way. We need to hear from educators about how it's going. So it's not so much that legislators need to be involved in that process. Classroom educators and their supports, as well as building and to some extent, district leadership need to be involved in that conversation of how it's going and how to make it go better. That is a piece of this, but it's only a piece of it. And so that's, I think, why it was, not highlighted near the top of the list.
More towards the top of the list, there's actually an entire category devoted to multi-tiered systems of support, or commonly referred to as MTSS. And those maybe not hyper involved in education, including myself, don't necessarily know what that is. It's also my understanding that Delaware already has some legal guidelines for MTSS. So I guess briefly, can you break that down a little bit further and why it gets its own category?
So MTSS is a system that's already in place through through regulations. I don't recall if it required legislation a few years ago. And the idea overall is that you've got both from an academic and non-academic perspective, this system that can help help guide students, help guide educators in interacting with the students. And I want to say sort of track, but not like in a negative way, and not like sort of in a nefarious kind of data, big government tracking sort of way, or private sector data, use of data. Is just the idea of just following a student through the process and being able to identify trends on the basis of what they're going through, and assuming that everyone plays their part, assuming that educators are able to log it, assuming that administrators at the building level in particular, and counselors are able to play their part, that you're able to kind of follow student along both academically and non-academically, and identify when there are. Well, identify broader trends, but also identify when there may be sort of like trigger points for a student where they seem to maybe be on a path where they're going to then escalate to a pattern of behavior, or likely enter into a sort of a zone in their life, a phase in their life, where they might then kind of escalate to a place where they become one of those students that people think of more commonly as trouble students. Overall, we have a system in place that if we allow it to unfold and we implement it with fidelity, that there's reason to believe that we will be able to identify those students that really could use some help here or there, so that they don't go from a very low risk situation to a higher risk situation. And then those students who are clearly entering into the higher risk situations really try to get the intervention for them that can be all the difference in the world between them having an incident in school that could set them back for months, if not years.
And then really going back to the funding piece, right? So, I mean, a lot of these recommendations, almost if not all of them, are going to need funding, right? I mean, there's several suggestions of hiring more behavior analysts, increasing state oversight of, individualized education programs or IEPs, looking into reducing class sizes, conducting more research, et cetera. The list goes on. There is a committee, as you referenced before, called the Public Education Funding Commission, that's already in the process of determining if Delaware should invest the magic numbers we keep hearing, $600 million to $1 billion more in education, and if we should rework our entire public education funding structure. So, really, my question is, how realistic do you think it is that these recommendations get the necessary funding? And I guess, how will those tie to the conversations that that commission is having right now?
I think it ties very much into it. I think it's not the only piece of it, but I think it's a big piece of it, because the behavior issues are not just because some students are coming to school with their stomachs empty. It's not just that some students are coming to school with other kinds of trauma from home, but that's part of it. Some of the behavior issues we see are, I think, to some extent, extensions of natural growth and development in children into adolescence, into young adulthood, and sorting those feelings out and sorting things out. There's so many different aspects of what can lead to student behavior challenges and school climate issues. Really, at the end of the day, all of them are relevant to the funding conversation, but the funding conversation is slightly broader than that, because it also has implications for students who essentially never have and probably never will go through, certain behavior issues. So it is all related. And to the first part of your question about mental health, I mean, there have been a very key growing focus on mental health supports in schools the past several years. But I think what came up in the conversations of our group was the sort of the realization, or at least the question, about whether or not the conception of that had been sort of very kind of medical driven from behavior health perspective, and maybe not as expansive as we needed to be in terms of understanding that some of the manifestations of people going through what people might consider mental health challenges could be from some of the drivers I just mentioned. I don't know if we can, or frankly should, draw the starkest line between, or even try to draw a stark line between what is sort of properly or clinically considered a mental health issue, but not student behavior, and vice versa, because I think there's a strong overlap. And so figuring out what kinds of staff supports, what kinds of credentialed professionals need to be in the schools to help sort out these issues, help students through these issues, so that classroom educators can focus on the academic enrichment as well as the non-academic extracurricular enrichment. We have to figure out that balance.
Another topic that was talked a lot about during the meetings was developing a more age-appropriate curriculum or incorporating play more so into curriculum for children. And I know that that's something, teachers, administrators, and parents have all kind of been talking about. It's not a new concept. So is that something that the task force really strongly wants to recommend or look forward to in the future?
Absolutely. It's a topic that came up during the task force. It had been a topic that was being discussed already, but in other corners prior to the task force. But we want to harmonize those streams of conversations and understand that play-based learning, play-based curriculum can be something that we have not done enough of over the years. Maybe got too focused on testing or older learner style teaching that really doesn't reach our youngest learners at that age in the way that we maybe thought it would. So we've got to do more play-based learning and curriculum so that our youngest learners are reached, they develop momentum, and they can really, get going in ways that might avoid some of the behavioral issues that might happen later if we are not effectively educating them at the youngest ages.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think wrapping up here, really just the question is kind of what are next steps? I mean, I know that whenever the AIR report came out, which talked about that funding piece of, the extra $600 million, and reworking the funding model, there was a joint hearing where they presented that report. I guess I'm curious, is something like that going to happen for this report as well? And do you see the committee meeting again in the future?
Certainly. So the committee expired like on election day by the operation of how the law often works on with task forces and committees. One of the immediate steps, I believe, is to try to reconstitute the group through legislation for at least 2 years, if not longer. And I think quickly sort out which of these recommendations need to involve legislative changes, but perhaps not have a fiscal impact. Which items might involve regulatory changes? Which items might involve just school districts or building level decision making? I think kind of sorting into a few categories of what has to be state level law, state level legislation versus state level regulation, what can be more local district level, what involves money, what doesn't involve money. We just kind of sort out the different categories, and I think just move as quickly on each of them as possible.
Thanks to State Senate Majority Leader Brian Townsend, Chair of the Student Behavior and School Climate Task Force, and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, a look at what to expect during this year's holiday shopping season. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. With Thanksgiving next week, the holiday shopping season moves into full swing. Retailers hope people are ready to spend big on gifts this year, while shoppers look for the trendiest gifts and best deals. What factors could play a role in what gifts and how many gifts land under the tree? Each year, we look to contributor Eileen Dalabrida to answer that question. Her preview of what retailers and shoppers can expect is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and she joined me earlier this week to talk about what she learned. So let's start with the basics. What's the overall forecast for holiday shopping from experts?
Well, Santa is going to need a bigger sled this year. Consumers are expected to spend $98.2 billion, that's almost a trillion, on holiday purchases, according to the National Retail Federation. And that's about 3% more than last year. Deloitte's holiday forecast is even merrier, with consumers spending 8% more than last year. And that's an average of $1,778 a person. And but part of that increase will come from shoppers with incomes of $100,000 and more.
So people on the high end seem ready to spend, maybe making up for others who have to tighten their belts. Are there any other factors that are driving sales, or is there any factors that could maybe eat into sales and maybe play the role of Grinch as the holidays approach?
Well, I think that if inventories are lean, and in many cases there are, if people can't get what they want, they may not settle for something else. They might just get a gift card or turn back their list. But I think that people are feeling pretty good about spending.
And one thing you note in your story that you found is that more people are planning to use credit cards to buy their gifts this year. Why is that? Is that an indication people are willing to up their budget, as you said?
Well, one of the things that is very enticing for consumers is the Buy Now, Pay Later, or BNPL programs, which allow buyers to break up their payments over several months. And I think people really like that. There is a very concerning delinquency rate in credit cards. And I don't know if holiday spending is going to impact that. The Fed says it's already 9%. And this holiday season, 85% of consumers are expected to use credit to make their holiday purchases. And 37% of consumers, according to Salesforce research, say they're using credit cards more than they did last year. 32% are those folks that are using the Buy Now, Pay Later plans. And 43% are just going to carry more debt.
That's interesting. I'm curious if some of that could also be driven by, at least on the big ticket items, any of those deals where you can have that 0% financing if you pay off within a certain amount of time. Do you think that could also be something that would entice someone to a bigger ticket purchase if they think they can pay it off without any interest?
I think that's very attractive. And especially since even if you can pay for it in cash, it makes sense to take the 0% interest because you can actually park that money in some sort of savings instrument that's going to get you decent interest.
So we always take a few minutes to talk about online sales compared to traditional brick and mortar shopping. What is the word on online sales this year? I assume they remain robust.
They are, and they're rising this year. 76% of consumers are going to make at least half of their holiday purchases online. And that's according to a Bain & Company survey. And online spending is projected to hit a record $248 billion. And of that, $40.6 billion will be spent during Cyber Week, which is the five-day period from Thanksgiving to Cyber Monday. And not surprising, Cyber Monday is expected to be the second highest shopping day of the season, second to Black Friday.
So while a lot of people are shifting into that mode for those Cyber Week savings, on the brick and mortar side of the equation, small local businesses certainly try to make the most of the holiday season, starting with Small Business Saturday next week. Are there good reasons to check out your small local shops to find some deals and some bargains and help your local economy?
Yes, absolutely. Shoppers tell me they're intentional about supporting small local businesses, and they enjoy the personal service. They appreciate getting advice on what to buy for folks on their list, and they enjoy that whole selection process and actually having a relationship with the merchant.
Meanwhile, with the big chain stores, are they still expecting to be busy with all these online sales? Are they still hiring extra staff, or has the atmosphere changed around those type of stores and how they approach the holiday season?
Well, the big three, Amazon, Costco, and Walmart, are expected to capture more than 40% of holiday dollars. And that's a lot. They are huge.
So is there a sense that there'll be more holiday employees in stores, or is that something of the past?
Actually, we have fewer people being hired for holiday shopping, that there is between 400 and 5,000 seasonal workers, and that's down from 509,000 last year. Christiana Mall held a holiday job fair in September in partnership with the Delaware State Department of Labor and to shake loose retail workers. But in Rehoboth, the stores at the Tanger outlets are still hiring.
Interesting. We've noted in recent years, Eileen, the timing of the holiday season seems to have shifted significantly. We see sales and store decorations much, much earlier than days gone by. Is there any indication that people actually do a significant amount of their shopping earlier, or is it just kind of the stores priming the pumps a little bit?
Well, people have indeed started shopping earlier. And I don't know if it's because we have a short season this year, a scant 26 days, or because all those decorations send a subliminal message to shoppers. Steve Chambliss, the general manager at Christiana Mall, tells me that foot traffic is brisk and started much earlier this year, but Black Friday is still the big day. 57% of shoppers plan to shop during Black Friday or that weekend because there are a lot of deals and discounts. But 24% said that they just enjoy it. They like it. It's fun.
Well, since you mentioned Black Friday, are there any big deals to watch for on Black Friday or otherwise as people really start to look at those lists and start checking them twice?
There are incredible deals on televisions. And so anybody who didn't get a new TV during the pandemic is in luck. There's Amazon has a 40-inch LED, and it includes Fire TV built in, so you can get access to all the streaming services without a separate streaming stick. And Alexa lets you control the television with voice commands, so you don't even have to reach for the remote. And that TV is $150.
Wow.
Best Buy is offering $200 off KitchenAid stand mixers and $130 off Sony headphones. Old Navy is selling crop tops for $1.97, reduced from $12.99.
Crazy, crazy deals. They're out there if you're looking for them. Anything else, Eileen, to keep an eye on this year? Are there some other, hot items that are expected to dominate this holiday season?
Well, you know, in recent years, smartwatches have gotten very popular. They track your health and they tell you how many steps. But if you're wearing that smartwatch, you can't be wearing your nice Movado or your Rolex or whatever. So now there is the Ring that is a standard health tracker, and it has sensors that track over 20 biometrics,
Wow.
sleep, stress, heart rate, all that. And so Best Buy has their huge Black Friday tech deal is $200 off the Oura Ring Generation 3 Horizon. It's and now priced at $350.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. A reminder, her piece on the holiday shopping season is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we get some expert advice on how to make your Thanksgiving dinner one to remember. This is The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The countdown to this year's most cherished feast is on. There's no shortage of things to do and buy if you're hosting Thanksgiving. And if you've only just started to plan for the festivities, it is time to roll up your sleeves and get cracking. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Colin McKinnon caught up with Emily Weinstein, editor-in-chief of New York Times Cooking and Food, and Leslie Stockton, senior staff writer reporting on all things cooking for the Times Wirecutter section, to talk tips for tackling the big day, fresh recipes, and time-honored classics.
Emily, we'll turn to you first. When should people start preparing for their Thanksgiving meal? I'm guessing the answer was yesterday, considering we're about a week out from the big day.
Now would be the time. I think at least, even if you are
a last minute cook, or you're just gonna kind of do something simple, this is a really good time to figure out like what that thing is, right? Make your shopping list, figure out what you need, figure out what else you're gonna have for dinner next week, right? Because if you're prepping for Thanksgiving and filling your fridge with ingredients, you still have to eat other stuff, right? In the days leading up to Thanksgiving. I think it helps really keep things calm if you just have a game plan going into Thanksgiving week. And so give yourself the time starting today to make that plan.
Broad strokes, what can you get done now? And I know a lot of this can be contextually based, but what can you get done now and what should be saved for day of or close to day of, like, turkey or other meats and stuffing and potatoes versus sauces, veggies, or even desserts? What should or can be done ahead of time and what can we wait on?
Well, first of all, if you are cooking a turkey that is frozen as of now, you're going to want to start defrosting it soon. Usually around Monday, you should be defrosting the turkey in the fridge. Don't leave that for Wednesday. It might not defrost in time. I can't tell you how many readers we hear from on Thursday morning saying, "My turkey is still frozen. What do I do?" Because the answer to that is like, buy some fried chicken. There's just nothing you can do if your turkey is still frozen on Thanksgiving morning. So I would say start defrosting your turkey in enough time to cook it. But in terms of what you could do right now, cranberry sauce is a great make-ahead dish. Potatoes, mashed potatoes usually taste best made in the moment, but you can make them ahead. We have a recipe for a make-ahead mashed potato casserole on NYT Cooking by Melissa Clark that I love and is very delicious. You can make that ahead. You can make pie crust for dessert. If you were making pies, make the dough now, stash it in the fridge, put it in the freezer. You can do that ahead. You want to leave time basically to focus on things like veggies and the turkey, things that need to be done in the moment. Think of everything else you can get done ahead of time and do it. Like a veggie casserole is another good example. You could make one of those.
And when it comes to preparation, Emily, that's really the key here, right? Being prepared is what gives you an edge in having an overall great Thanksgiving meal.
I think so. I mean, Thanksgiving is tricky, right? It's wonderful. It's delicious. We do it every year. But it's tricky because, most home cooks, they have the oven. Maybe they have a double oven, but there's the oven and there's the stovetop. And you have to kind of figure out how everything is going to move in your kitchen. What's the dance? You want to serve everything warm. It's a logistics challenge, which is part of why we put so much effort in NYT Cooking to help you prep for that, right? Now, look, you can use a grill, you can use an air fryer, you can use a slow cooker, but you want to plan for that. Otherwise, the day of is going to be pretty crazy. And my hope for everybody that is that on Thanksgiving Day, you're finishing things off, you're having a drink, if that's what you like to do, you're able to relax a little bit once the meal is served, or even before the meal is served, you're able to have some time that day to like catch your breath.
Yeah, decompress a little bit. All right, Leslie, let's pivot your way then. I understand that you've cooked more than 100 turkeys. I personally have only cooked one turkey in my lifetime, and it was a big bird and a fairly overwhelming process, which I imagine is the feeling for a lot of folks out there. So, can you break down the essential roasting equipment that we need, maybe some of the do's and don'ts and any other helpful bits that'll streamline and make it all more manageable?
Absolutely. If you want to break it down to just distill it down to the most simple process possible, you're going to want a roasting pan. Now, if you don't have a roasting pan, or if you're not interested in buying one, a foil pan from the grocery store works just fine. But having a dedicated roasting pan, it is very helpful because not only is it sturdy and a good one has really nice, roomy, sturdy handles, and which is great when you're dealing with a 15-pound turkey. Also, when that turkey is finished cooking and you've transferred it to the carving board to rest, you can just put that pan directly on the stovetop and make your gravy without having to dirty another pot or pan, or even if you have one to spare, because I think we're all using the max capacity of our cookware arsenal at that moment. So, what I think is the most important thing to have is like a nice carving board that has a channel around the side so that when you do carve that turkey, those juices have somewhere to go. A good knife and patience. Patience and restraint. If you're cooking a turkey for the first time, I'm a firm believer in, now, Emily, you please feel free to jump in and, but I put it in the oven and I leave it alone. Now, I salt it for 3 days before, yada, yada, yada. The only thing I do is I check and make sure that juices are accumulating in the bottom of the pan, because if you don't have any drippings, you don't have anything to make turkey from. You definitely need an instant read meat thermometer. I think this is the most important day of the year to have one of those. When it's inserted into the thickest part of the thigh, it registers as, I think the USDA says 165, and that is the number I will be sticking with for this.
Well, I have some very quick questions then for both of you. Emily, for those out there who were thinking about trying a new recipe for Thanksgiving, is this the right time to do that, given the gravity of the holiday? Is that more of a downtime thing?
You know, some people would say never make a recipe you've never made before for like a huge group of people on a special occasion, like do a test run at home first. But I don't know. It's not a restaurant. Like every, you know, just go for it. Cook what you want. Try something new. I mean, a lot of the things that are traditionally eaten at Thanksgiving are things that people just like don't cook all year round, even pie, you know. And I say go for it. Like, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? Like, cook to make yourself happy. Like, have a good time.
That's right. Go for it. And definitely not speaking for myself here, but what if we have a vegetarian at the table? What are some good, filling plant-based alternatives to meat as far as that main dish is concerned?
Hey, you know, I know a lot of vegetarians who are devoted to the tofurkey, even after all these years. Don't make it at home, just buy it. But I'm a big believer in recommending that people just elevate the sides. Like, you could make an amazing dinner out of like what we think of as the traditional Thanksgiving sides, right? Like, make a really fabulous macaroni and cheese, you know, like have a big dish of greens, potatoes, sweet potatoes, mushrooms, squash, like much of what we eat at Thanksgiving on the side is plant-based or can easily be made plant-based. You know, I think there are a lot of people who would just as soon never have turkey. I feel turkey is part of the meal, but you could make a great dinner just thoughtfully thinking about those side dishes. If you do want to do something special, like you could do a big centerpiece, you know, you could do like a big squash thing. Like, you just kind of want a special moment. If you want the thing at the center of the table, like do a beautiful platter of like roasted vegetables and mushrooms and protein, you know, you could do that, or just make the side smashing. You'll be all good.
I love this general through line here, this messaging of making it your own and going for it and doing what you want. I think a lot of people will be very comforted by that. As far as desserts go then, Leslie, outside of the traditional pumpkin pie, and Emily touched on this a bit earlier, what are some desserts you recommend for Thanksgiving?
Oh, this is definitely where I shine because I love making pie. I know. I think pie is my favorite thing to make. I make the obligatory pumpkin pie, but then I have fun with the rest of them. I always make a fruit galette from whatever fruit looks best at the market, and it changes every year. Sometimes it's the suckle pears. Sometimes it's something completely different, but I always make sure to highlight something that was really special at the market the previous day. If you've never made a pie before and you're nervous, make a buttermilk pie. Look up the recipe. It's so simple. It's like 4 or 5 ingredients. Yeah, I'm a bad person to ask because I will just make any pie. But pecan pie. I've made lemon meringue pie before, and that was a huge hit for Thanksgiving. Just, you know, get creative with it. If you don't want pumpkin pie, you don't have to have it.
That's right. Leslie, you're certainly invited to, I don't know if you'll be in Wisconsin for Thanksgiving like I'll be, but you're invited over. All right. Well, New York Times Cooking has a new cookbook out, Easy Weeknight Dinners. It's a beautiful book, very intuitive and easy to follow. But Emily, I think this cookbook really is a saving grace of sorts for a lot of people out there. that struggle with making quality dishes on weeknights. Was that the reasoning, or at least part of the reasoning, for putting this cookbook together?
Oh, absolutely. We know intuitively, just as cooks ourselves here, you know, at MIT Cooking, we know that intuitively, but we also hear from readers all the time from our audience that, like, these are the recipes they really, really need. And, you know, Thanksgiving comes but once a year, right? And everyone needs recipes for that as well. But dinner is every night over and over and over again, right? And we saw a space for us there, you know, to give people really amazing recipes, like New York Times quality recipes that didn't have to take 2 hours and then another half hour of washing the dishes. You know, we can give you really, really great ideas that you could make relatively quickly, wash your dishes, be done, and get on with the evening and other things you might want to do.
Thanks to Editor-in-Chief of New York Times Cooking and Food, Emily Weinstein, Senior Staff Writer for the Times Wirecutter section, Leslie Stockton, and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying, thanks for joining us this week. The Green takes a break next week for the Thanksgiving holiday, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.